Everything to me is data. So I looked at 10 years of what they call studio ultimates to see whether or not there was any there, right? Was this the quote Hollywood accounting joke that there was no money to be made, or could you? So I convinced myself that you could, with the right setup, you could park yourself adjacent to the Hollywood ecosystem and rely on that machine and their distribution and remain disciplined and, of course, make great movies and television, that there was a business there.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Thomas Tull is the founder of Legendary Entertainment. Legendary Entertainment was one of the first companies to jointly finance films with movie studios, partnering with Warner Brothers in 2005. As an outsider coming into Hollywood, Thomas Tull truly left his mark. Legendary was acquired by the Chinese entertainment conglomerate Wanda for a reported $3.5 billion in 2016. Today, Thomas thinks he is on to bigger things with Tulco LLC. Tulco is a holding company that helps its portfolio companies apply technology such as AI, machine learning, and predictive data analytics. In this episode, find out how Tull's childhood passions, Batman, Led Zepp, and the Pittsburgh Steelers, have followed him throughout his career. Thomas's fascinating story is coming up after the break. Now, let me ask you a question. Are you frustrated with how long it takes to get stuff done in your business, or with how chaotic or confusing things seem to get? Well, then let me tell you about a much better way of getting work done. And let me tell you about an amazing tool that will help you overcome the frustrating log jams in your business. Sweet Process is a simple but powerful tool that lets you create clear step-by-step instructions for every task in your business, from onboarding new customers to training employees to responding to customer requests, so everything gets done more easily and more reliably. Plus, you'll have a central place where everyone who works with you, your employees, contractors, and even virtual assistants can access your procedures anytime from any device. The best way to understand how Sweet Process streamlines your work is to start using it. The company offers a 14-day free trial, but as a loyal listener of the How Success Happens podcast, you can try it for 28 days free of charge. You don't even have to enter a credit card to get started. Just navigate to sweetprocess.com/HSH to start your free 28-day trial today. And now, on with the show. We're back. I recently sat down with Thomas and began by asking him about how his childhood has shaped him.
I grew up, our family was pretty poor, and was raised by a single mom. And so that has its own set of circumstances. Certainly watched her work very hard. She worked two jobs to try to just cover the bills. I worked from a very young age just to try to help with that endeavor. So, at the time, I certainly wasn't loving it, and at times would be frustrated because your very young mind, and perhaps even today, can't really process that in a mature way or look at this as, hey, this is character building. No, back then, it's just, this sucks. But between shoveling snow, mowing lawns, and those sorts of things, but at a young age, having to pitch in and help out, I'm sure that had some kind of impact. But it also definitely taught me that, hey, if there's work at hand, it's not going away. You have to do it. You can't sometimes outthink it or outmaneuver it. You just have to do it.
Yeah. And I know you also, I think, were pretty involved in sports. And was that one of your outlets growing up?
Without a question. Sports was an enormous part of my life. I was fortunate enough to be pretty good. And I played baseball, basketball, and football. And what I loved about it is the meritocracy. I wasn't poor on the field, right? Then it's just, can you play or not play? And there's a scoreboard that you're measured against. And it's one of the things that I hold dear to this day, that I think an athletic mindset is certainly something you can tap into in terms of being resilient, being sort of oriented towards a no excuses, no one cares, no one's going to sit around and talk about the call that was blown or why you weren't prepared. And to this day, I'll sort of say there may be 100 good reasons, solid reasons that the thing happened, but if it happened, no, the world doesn't care. So I am extraordinarily fortunate. I had great coaches all the way through. I still, obviously, sports is still a big part of my life. It's something that I love. And I think that even as a society, we have to, I think, continue to land the plane between certainly being inclusive and participation is fantastic, but I'm not the world's biggest believer in participation trophies and things of that nature. I think that if you look at the natural world and so forth, things compete and you have to prepare for them.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And just from coaching my daughter and her soccer game this weekend, she's 11, and it's so different nowadays in terms of wanting to make everyone feel good and wanting to make everyone feel, you know, like they're the greatest player on the team. And like you just said, that's just not realistic, right? In the real world.
It isn't. And I ultimately don't think it's good for the child. I think that, again, let me be clear, nobody is getting a scholarship, you know, in fourth grade, or at least most cases. So I do think age-appropriate competitiveness, age-appropriate encouragement is very important. But at the same time, and it extends, I think, to all areas. I'm sure I see this all the time, where a set of parents or individuals will tell that child that they're the best at everything. And while A, that's not true, and B, I just don't think it's not realistic, and it's not a very good growth formula, I don't think. I think a very positive, encouraging, but at the same place, same time, I think truthfulness and saying, hey, in some cases, as we get older, we're going to be weighed and measured, and we're going to have to be resilient and work through things. There's a lot of times things will be beyond our control. But if we're prepared to move beyond that and say, okay, I'm going to spend a moment on, this is very unfair, this is very unfortunate, but I still have to accomplish whatever it is. So now I have to reset and figure it out. And I think that's a mindset and a skill set.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And you grew up, as you mentioned, without a lot of money, and you end up going to Hamilton College, which is a great school. I only know because one of my really smart friends actually ended up going there. And you also played football there. And what was that change like for you from coming from NWEL and then being at this school? And I'm sure meeting all different types of people from different backgrounds.
Well, first of all, I'm incredibly fortunate. I got a great education. And one of the things that was a culture shock for me was many of the students at that school had gone to prep schools, had gone to these private schools with famous names, but I had no idea what that was. You know, I felt a little bit like a rube because I just had no, where I grew up, the rich people in our towns, the fathers had jobs and maybe worked at the IBM factory, or, you know, maybe were a doctor. So it was just a completely different mindset. I didn't know what a trust fund was. I didn't know any of those things, but fortunately, and I'm a big proponent of a liberal arts education, because I think it teaches you not just, okay, here are the things, right? Memorize these things, but it teaches you how to think, how to communicate, which are things that are, to me, are invaluable to this day. And it's one of the things that I believe very much in today's business environment, that you have to be flexible, you have to be pliable, you have to be able to move with some fluidity, because the challenges and the velocity that those challenges come at, that are complete pivots, they're not like, well, it's 2% different than it was 5 years ago, I think require leaders and people to understand that they have to adopt, they have to overcome, and they have to do it quickly. And those skill sets, I think, have to be well-developed and embraced, not something to be afraid of, because it's here, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. And when you were at school or in going through your years there, was there any, did you have issues? I mean, in terms of, you know, when you go to school, and I had a similar situation going to school, and these kids from schools I'd never heard of, but they cost money to go to private schools. And to, like, was there ever any issues, or did you ever feel any shame, lack of self-worth? And did that ever occur to you, or were you just always, like, seemingly now, pretty confident?
No, it occurred to me. I mean, growing up with a single mom who obviously had a hard time getting up there because she's working two jobs. So parents' weekend, you know, sort of be hey, guess what? This is different. And then I think I always knew that we were poor. Like that was very obvious. But once you get out in the big blue world, then it became very obvious. And I think it definitely drove me. And, you know, I had, I'm certainly not proud of this, but there was a time that there was somebody on campus that I was having a disagreement with. And this guy started making fun of me for being a public school guy. And so I sorted that out physically, which I'm not, it's the wrong answer, certainly. But it just, yes, provided a stark contrast, but something that without question, all these things shape who you become for good or for bad. And at the time, there were a lot of things that if I could have wished my way out of it, I certainly would have. But in retrospect, it was very, very fortunate to grow up the way I did. I had an aunt and uncle that helped raise me that were phenomenal, very blue collar. And it still, I'm sure, impacts me to this day.
Yeah. I wonder where that guy is now. That's pretty funny. Seeing what you did. But you've been incredibly successful. We'll get into some of the things you're doing today are mind-boggling. And obviously, some of the things you've done in the past with Legendary Entertainment. And I wanted to get into that. But in terms of the drive, because you have obviously had this incredible drive, where does that, do you think, come from?
I don't know. I mean, for me, it's involuntary. It's the way that I'm wired. I am sure some environmental aspect of it as well. But it just, I guess the thing that has been in me as long as I can remember is just wanting to be successful in whatever I went into. Whatever I was going to put my time into, it became important to me that I was good at that. And so that can be healthy or it can be unhealthy, right? If it goes too far. But I think the other thing that's been a big part of my life is very fortunate to have been wired with what I would call intellectual curiosity. So wanting to understand why things are the way they are academically, as well as just escapism, great stories, wanting to read. I have been a voracious reader my whole life. And I think that is extremely fundamental for me, because you're able to stand on the shoulders of and be right alongside some of the greatest thinkers in history. So I think those things all have kind of gone into some kind of a pot. But I have to say, like, I also am incredibly aware of how fortunate I am, because my life at different junctures could have gone an inch to the left or the right. And you certainly wouldn't be asking me to come and be on your podcast. So I think one of the things that I try to remember all the time is that, look, but for that luck, things could very, very well be different. So you want to remain sufficiently paranoid, I guess I would say, that it's not a birthright. It's not, hey, I'm just so whatever that if I show up, good things are going to happen. I don't believe that. And I also think that I'm constantly thinking about time. I am drawn to stoicism and sort of that stoic philosophy. They have their phrase, memento mori, which is you're going to die eventually. And rather than looking at that in a macabre way, it's, hey, this thing does have an end date. So you better be using your time in not only a productive way, but to constantly think about, am I living the life? Am I doing things that are fulfilling, that are real and personal and true to me? And it's interesting, because COVID is certainly nothing that any of us expected in our lifetime. I recently read a book about the Spanish flu of 1918 and was shocked at the politicized mask wearing, the cities that took it seriously and didn't in the stark contrast. I mean, it's, you could have taken many of the stories and taken the dates out and been eerily similar. But I know a lot of people that have come through this. And for the most part, my own personal experience is people don't change. For the most part, there are efforts, but at the end of the day, they kind of are who they are. I've personally witnessed some people that I know very well that have come out of this, and you can't believe the difference. And thankfully, all I think for a greater appreciation of life in general and just friendships and wanting to be connected and communal and all those things. So I think this is one of those things that'll sort of be so profound that it's marked, it was before or it was after. And we're seeing there are going to be second and third order effects of this, certainly, that are going to impact society in ways that we probably haven't thought of yet.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more, just from my own personal experience and realizing just how important living through that isolation and anxiety, just how important friendships, people, connection, which I think just I was taking for granted for a long time. And it sounds like some of the people you know are experiencing that as well or experienced it, and just hoping that that does help people change and see more clearly. And I want to go back though to those first days. And this was pretty cool. I had read that your first job out, or just when you were starting, was actually as a baseball scout. That's always something I love baseball. And I would love, I mean, it just always seemed like the best. You're sitting in the bleachers eating some peanuts and what, like, how did that come about? Because I know you were playing football mainly, right?
At baseball school. And football. And I got an opportunity and got a look with the Braves organization. And they very smartly decided that I would help them more in the scouting department because I was a pretty good baseball player. But then you start to realize that it's a big world out there. So I was offered a job as an area scout part-time. I was just doing it part-time. But really great experience because you get to not only see a lot of baseball and things of that nature, but you're also kind of in the dream business, right? Meaning you're watching somebody that you could potentially sign and who knows and all those things. So it was really fun. And I signed one young man who actually made the big league. So that was pretty cool.
How awesome is that?
Yeah. It was a fun chapter.
Yeah. So tell me about at that time, just getting into more of entrepreneurial, and I know you were shoveling driveways, doing everything you could back in the day growing up, but you start, which I love because I love the grittiness, especially after you've kind of revolutionized a couple industries. But tell me if I'm wrong, but the first business you started was actually coin-operated laundromats. And I'm just so curious how you got into that and what was that like?
Yeah, well, you know, it's fascinating. I get asked about the everybody, I'm shocked at, first of all, the deep research departments that folks have, but second of all, just the same reaction that you had to. So I had an auto repair place that I knew nothing about. To this day, if you ask me to change oil, I couldn't. But in the area that I lived in, it was economically challenged. And so what are the things that service areas that are economically challenged? Well, I'm not going to buy a new car. I'm going to fix the old one. I may not have a good washing and dryer at my place or my apartment, so I have to go out to a laundromat. So those are the things that I built. And with the coin-operated thing, this has kind of been a running theme throughout my career, is that we had a problem, which was that we were jam-packed during the weekends, but during the week, it was pretty slow. And so I was trying to think about how to even that out so that you didn't have people on the weekend. Sometimes customers would like, I'm not going to wait that long. I'm leaving. So the problem was how to incentivize the crowd that whether they were retirees or had the time during the week to come. And so I wanted to incentivize them with price. And so went to one of the manufacturers, and they were just about to come out with a computerized system. So the idea was that A, you can help me keep track of everything, but B, you can give me dynamic pricing because it's programmable. So that dynamic pricing in my little laundromat chain had a pretty big impact. And that was probably the first case of using technology to effectuate a seemingly sleepy space, so to speak.
And was that the first time you kind of woke up to what technology could do? Because I know that's played a kind of a constant theme in all these other businesses that you've started in the business you're in today?
No question about it. From a young age, kind of observed, if you could deploy a technology that was powerful and you could compete against others that didn't have that, well, history tells you what the result is. So, you know, one of the things that I know about my own skill sets, if there are any, is that I'm not great at coming up with a brand new thing. Like, there's a new category that's never existed and I invented that category. That's not my forte. But looking at a business and understanding where the inefficiencies are, where the growth opportunities are, and reimagining it or tweaking it so that it's has different outcomes, that's probably been the thematic of my career. And so that's how I think about things as I kind of get into it.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. And obviously, one of the industries that was absolutely ripe for it, but I just personally would never think anyone would be able to change, which you really did, was Hollywood and legendary entertainment. And can you just take me back to, I know you had started a Tax Services America accounting firm. And how did that start? And then how did it transfer into this incredible business idea with Legendary?
Well, there are a couple of skips in between, but the Tax Services of America was a roll-up, and it was really out of necessity because there was a guy in my hometown who was an accountant who said, hey, there's these six, I think it was, Jackson Hewitt stores, this business for sale, and I had made some money, and I'm an accountant, you have money, we should buy this. So we did, and the idea was to run them more efficiently and then sell them back to the parent company. That was kind of the deal we had. And the parent company was bought by Cendant Corporation out of Parsippany, New Jersey, who was only interested in the royalty streams. And at that time, I think we had 18 or 20 locations. And I'm like, how the heck am I going to get out of this? Because it's not my calling. This was kind of a financial transaction. So the only way I could think of was to make it big enough that Cendant would want to do something with it. And so I got two other large franchisees together. And then we went out and acquired hundreds of these things and ultimately sold it. And then with Legendary, I was at Tech Venture Fund as a partner for a while, making tech investments, Research Triangle Park down to Atlanta, out sometimes to Silicon Valley. And I became fascinated with the economic models of content because I felt like as you had the internet getting faster and as you had cable channels going crazy at the time and everything, that you were going to need more content. And then when I looked at what was happening overseas in the international market, they were building theaters at an incredible pace. So everything to me is data. So I looked at 10 years of what they call studio ultimates to see whether or not there was any there, right? Was this the quote Hollywood accounting joke that there was no money to be made or could you? So I convinced myself that you could, with the right setup, and if you could park yourself adjacent to the Hollywood ecosystem and rely on that machine and their distribution and remain disciplined and, of course, make great movies and television, that there was a business there. And so I partnered with Warner Brothers, which was just, again, very fortunate. There was a guy there named Alan Horn, who now is the head of Disney Studios, and is just to this day a dear friend, great mentor, Harvard business grad, as well as having his, you know, creative mind. So we met a young man named Chris Nolan at the time, who turned out to be one of the greatest directors of all time. And we ended up making five movies with him. So along the way, there were a couple of fairly big pivots that made a pretty material difference in our approach. One of which was understanding early that China was going to be a market that you couldn't just say, can I please put my movie in? Because there were only 25 slots a year and everybody was trying to get into China. And for a while, Legendary had, I don't have it in front of me, so I don't want to exaggerate, but I think it was either four or five of the top 10 movies of all time in China were Legendary. So we had incredible success there. And one of the things that we did was to have an office there and really spend time on building the brand locally. so we did that. And then on the data side, I got very frustrated that most of the, on the marketing side, we spent a tremendous amount of money and most of the programs were the same, right? So the Hangover was the same as the Dark Knight, was the same as for We Are Marshall. So I wanted to use data science and analytics, try to find people that were persuadable. You know that old advertising joke, only half of it, your ad budget is effective if you only knew which half.
Exactly.
So the true north on this was to try to find out who is persuadable. So if we were doing Dark Knight, I always use the line that if there's a 15-year-old kid wearing a Batman t-shirt, don't spend money on it. He's coming. And if you gave my mom $20 and free tickets, she wouldn't go. So let's not bother her. So we bought an analytics shop in Boston, kind of a boutique place led by this guy, Matt Miralda, who I still work with to this day and is phenomenal. And we built a pretty powerful analytics engine and it worked. And then we started licensing it to all the other studios, ported it over to television. And again, it was another lesson in the amplification of results that you could get by employing technology into spaces where that sort of innovation hadn't been there historically.
Yeah, it's really amazing when you look at it and think about it. And what was that like for you? Was it difficult initially? Because you were, you know, I know Hollywood's a tight-knit group, but you were able to, I guess, convince Alan, or I don't even know if he, how it worked out to really partner. Was that a tough challenge?
Yes, because I was, I think, 32 years old and I had zero experience, 31, 32, zero experience at all in media, zero. And so to go out and raise the kind of money, which was $500 million that you needed to have table stakes, and then to say to Warner Brothers, hey, I want to partner with you. I want to make movies with you. You distributed them. They got a fee and so forth. And they loved being able to stretch their dollars. We'd usually go 50-50 on a movie. They put up half, we put up half. And then we, of course, knew that we had to develop our own content. Because if all you are is a, quote, film fund, there's no multiple against that. There's no way to really build. You watch what Pixar did. You watch what Marvel was able to do. And you knew that you had to control your destiny. If you made great content that drove the system, then you could build something very valuable. And so that's what we attempted to do. But yes, it was still to this day probably the hardest thing I've done in my career, because there was no, I couldn't point to anything. I could just be emphatic and say, this is, look at the data. Here's what I think we can do. And it, you know, unfortunately worked out.
What was that like when, you know, I guess they finally agreed and said, let's do this? Do you recall?
Euphoric, because it was hiring accountants and bankers and lawyers and going out and trying to raise the money. It was extremely expensive. And I was all in on this. So it was nerve-wracking. And Warner Brothers, again, back in those early days, was just such a phenomenal partnership between Alan. There was a guy named Steve Spira there who ran their business group. It was just, they were, if they told you something, they would do it, they did it. And that was something that whenever you stand back and you kind of unpack, why did this happen? There are certain things like that may seem quaint, but they're not. They're not, because I was a complete novice at this. And being able to have a partner that was actually interested in our success, I can't speak intelligently about what it would have been like in the rest of Hollywood, but I would be very doubtful that it would have been the same experience. So that's something that I list as one of those bounces that you just have to recognize how lucky you were.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Hey, business owner, did you know that over 4.2 billion people are active on social media now? That means if you want to connect with your customers or find new ones, you need social. If you want to build loyalty and stand out from the competition, you need social. And if you want to make using social media easier, more impactful, you need Hootsuite. Hootsuite is the must-have tool for managing and growing your business on social. Hootsuite makes it easy to find your audience, whether on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, or Pinterest. You can schedule content, publish posts, and track your success all in one place. Millions of businesses around the world are already using Hootsuite to supercharge their social efforts. And now it's your turn. Go to hootsuite.com/HSH to start your free trial and get 50% off your first year. That's hootsuite.com/HSH for a free 30-day trial and 50% off your first year.
And our next sponsor.
This always happens to me these days. I look up from my laptop and it's already 3 p.m. Where has the day gone? I'm starving, only I can't leave because I have a Zoom coming up in the next 15 minutes. Starving, I then remember that I have DoorDash to turn to. Pull out my phone, order my favorite sandwich, and have it delivered right to my door. Satisfied and re-energized, I'm fueled up for my next Zoom meeting. In today's work environment, employee happiness is vital. This is why DoorDash for Work has a new kind of benefit for companies and their employees. Food benefits can help employee culture, performance, and productivity. With a Dash Pass for Work subscription, employees get free delivery and reduced fees on eligible orders from restaurants, grocery, and convenience stores, giving them time back in their day. Get DoorDash for Work and make work delicious. Go to work.doordash.com/success to learn more. That's work.doordash.com/success. Terms and conditions apply.
And we're back.
Obviously, you guys did pretty well, really changed Hollywood and revolutionized a lot of how business was being done. And eventually, how did the Wanda deal come? And if you just explain to people who might not know who Wanda is, if you can let us know kind of the path towards getting acquired.
I had dinner or lunch, I guess it was the first. I was in China and met Chairman Wang, who at the time was the wealthiest man in China. Wanda at the time was about the same size as Comcast here, give or take. Very large Chinese company that was it really had its roots in real estate, grew into theme parks, theaters, owned AMC, owned their own production in China. So very big, important company. And I just right away kind of hit it off with him and understood what he was trying to build. Because Legendary, I think, had our films had done well there and our brand was, you know, was well known there. I think that was part of what got them excited about it. And then getting that deal closed over a year-long process might have actually eclipsed raising the initial money. It was just arduous, to say the least. I mean, just every day was a, wait a minute, what's the Rubik's Cube look like today? And it was just a very, very difficult slog. So, but we eventually got it done and, you know, they still own the company to this day.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting having done some business in China. As you know, when I was with CAA and just how hard and difficult it is, when I look at that deal and what you did is really amazing. And what I love about it is that it was in the making for maybe 10 plus years. Like you said, you knew China was going to be growing in terms of wanting content and you put an office there and you got your brand name out there. And to me, that seems like a big part of why this may have ultimately happened?
I think so. Another CAA alum, Peter Lohr, came and worked for us and had lived in China for 20 years and spoke fluent Mandarin and certainly knew every nook and cranny. And that was extremely helpful. But yeah, I mean, we put the time in for sure. And I'll tell you, without a question, 90 to 180 days after we closed, I don't think we would have closed. Because we closed in March of 2016. And then you think about what happened politically, yeah. What has happened since then. And certainly Wanda has had its own sort of things happen. So, yeah, I mean, it was one moment in time.
Yeah.
Barely one moment in time.
But yeah, incredible. So I just want to take us up to today or the last few years, because to me, what you're doing now, you know, with Tulco, and I just want you to explain that. To me, has or could have you know, an impact even greater than with your impressive resume, anything you've done in the past. And I just want you to talk a little bit about how it came about and exactly what you're doing.
Well, watching, again, the impact of technology gave me the sort of the thesis around being able to take not only capital, but to partners with companies that were in, you can call it whatever you want, sleepy spaces, a lack of innovation, things of that nature, and to not only provide capital and business wherewithal, but to actually bring the technical skills to bear. Because in terms of investing, I do had done a ton of personal investing in tech. And there's the Silicon Valley model, which is we're going to change things from the outside in, right? We're going to disrupt. And everybody talks about that. And that's hard in a lot of industries. And so the idea was that I wanted to have a holding company model. So I'm not really a 2 in 20. The whole raising funds all the time and running a fund was not my thing. So the holding company model would allow us to buy companies. In almost every case, we buy the whole thing or a majority stake. And then to have Tolko Labs in the middle of it, a bunch of practitioners in artificial intelligence, machine learning, data science. Because in some of these industries, it would be extremely difficult to recruit teams that I'll leave Google and go join X, Y, and Z. That's a tough thing to do. So in this case, to build a world-class team that we could then deploy to help build these things out. Knock on wood, it's worked very, very well. Because we're not a fund, we don't have a ton of companies. We had a pretty strict criteria, one of which was to partner with great management teams that embraced using technology to create change. And it also gives us maximum flexibility around, we don't have vintage year dates, so we're not worried about raising the next fund or anything like that, you know, more permanent capital. And we're able to let the companies grow at the pace that they need to grow at. And whether it's looking at a public option, whether it's looking at M&A, either for them or selling them, there's no artificial pressure on, hey, we have to get this done because this is out of fund three and fund three is about to be up. And so just for me, it's worked well and allows me to partner with fantastic management teams that operate the businesses and to try to provide certainly the technology and hopefully some hard city miles wisdom of doing the things I've done over the past 20 years. But that's basically the thesis.
In addition to Thomas's successful work as an entrepreneur, he has some pretty incredible hobbies and passions. Thomas is the guitarist in a band called the Ghost Hounds, which has opened for the Rolling Stones, gone on tour with ZZ Top, and even played at a few of Bob Seger's concerts. In addition, Thomas grew up as a diehard Steelers fan and is living his childhood dream, now being a part owner of the organization. As Thomas and I were catching up after he notably stated that he still gets to be part of all the things he loved as a child, Godzilla, Batman, the Steelers, and the Rolling Stones. And ultimately, that's how success happens. And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.